I do wonder if it's just a fad, right? If this is just a fad that's going to go away soon, because it seems like these types of systems pop up and go, especially around agents, you know. But then I looked and, you know, this, you know, Claude bot, Maltbot, you know, it is real and meaningful.
All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to another episode of Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a panel of the sharpest minds working at the very frontiers of artificial intelligence to make sense of the week's news. Joining us today are three brilliant recurring panelists. We've got Kautar El-Megrawi, Principal Research Scientist, AI Platforms, Marina Danilevsky, Senior Research Scientist, and Aaron Botman, IBM Fellow and Master Inventor. Welcome back to you all, and Happy New Year. We have a packed episode today, as always. We're going to talk a little bit about Dario Amodei's new, very long essay. We'll talk about IBM at the Grammys. And finally, we'll talk about Microsoft's new inference chip, the Maya 200. But first, I actually really wanted to start with Claudebot, which I think actually as of yesterday is now named Moltbot. If you haven't been watching social media, this is an open source project that has kind of taken, I guess, AI a little bit by storm. It's effectively an open source AI agent that you can plug both local and proprietary models like OpenAI and Anthropic into. And it's really been having like a moment. People are really crazy about it. I think one funny bit about it is you can run these like you can many open source agent projects on a little Mac Mini. And so it's kind of sparked all these people running Claudebot or now Moltbot on their Mac Minis and you know, driving up purchases of Mac Minis all over the place. Marina, I wanted to ask you, like, why? You know, Claudebot or now Moltbot, these are like, people have been doing open source agent projects for a very long time. Is there any reason why this one seems to have caught flame? Is there anything different that they're doing?
I think because of all of the little integrations that they have with all sorts of things, this has caught the imagination of everyone in the GTD community, the get things done, the life hacking, personalization, all of that. Because I looked at what people are building, what people are excited about, and it is various ways to do variations on personal assistant. So, you know, we used to have other ways to do it with if this then that scripts and this thing and that thing. And this is another really fun iteration on that thing. So this is very personal, it's very easy, and you can get both very practical and very silly with it. So it's a fun thing to follow.
Aaron, I think you know, one impression that I had from this is I had a very similar view as Marina. I was like seeing what people were building and we're like, this is like, it's not really complicated stuff. And the joke always is like everybody when they get agents immediately wants to buy, like create like a vacation booking platform or a vacation booking agent. And I guess, I don't know, what I want to ask you is like, do we feel like we're just have been setting the bar for agents too high? Like basically like what we want an agent to do and like what people have really wanted to do is like some actually kind of pretty simple stuff, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, in this case, you know, I asked myself, you know, how's this any different than any other orchestrator, you know, that we have, right? Because, I mean, it seems as though this just goes out and it follows like that vertical integration hypothesis, you know, that if agents can integrate, then they become truly functional, right? And then therefore people want to use it. And so I think that the bar needs to be set even higher, right? As far as what these agents can do so we can model chain, you know, these different pieces together, much like what, you know, this product is doing. You know, it's this Node.js app that can run on a laptop, right? And then that goes out and then it can integrate with other multi-models, right? You can even have a model run locally, right? Small model, right? And then it can use that, but then it also integrates to like WhatsApp and all these different other tools, you know, that people use, you know, and, you know, I do wonder if it's just a fad, right? If this is just a fad that's going to go away soon, because it seems like these types of systems pop up and go, especially around agents, you know. But then I looked and, you know, this, you know, Claudebot, Maltbot, you know, it is real and meaningful, you know, today. But it may not remain the dominant open source agent, you know, framework forever.
Yeah. And what do you think, like, will lead to that? Like, I think, I mean, maybe it's mysterious about how this one got so popular all of a sudden, but, you know, do you think there's just competitive pressures that make it really difficult for any of these open source projects to really continue to have kind of persistent adoption and use?
Yeah, well, I think the reason why this became so popular is it hits a real need. You know, it has this vertical integration, you know, that I think others lack, right? And it also has an open source network, you know, behind it. You know, so there's this big community that helps to adopt it and to develop it, and it's a larger voice, right? And this also follows a larger trend where it shifts these agents with memory, execution, and you can sync across all these different types of apps here. But it could be a replace very quickly, right? You know, just because of this rapid innovation, you know, this is a very specific architecture in UX. There's dependency risk, right? And if you compare it, right, to others that are out there, it really focuses in on a specific kind of user, right? Whereas others don't, right? So I think because of that, right, there's all these white space room of another player to jump in, right, and sort of reduce some of these risk, right, that it does pose, right? And it doesn't have things like multimodal integration, dynamic plugins, you know, a lot of this personalizations that I think we're going to see. You know, I didn't see too many guardrails with it either, right? So, you know, the whole trustworthy aspect of it, it seems to be a little suspect, you know, but I think those vulnerabilities need to be shored up. And I think this open source network behind it will help some.
Yeah, for sure. It's like, I think, Marina, what you're saying is like the getting things done community. It's almost like it really worked in part because it was like really well-tuned for like this very specific group of people with very specific desires for what they want to do with agents. Katzer, maybe I can bring you into the conversation. We were joking, I think, on last week's episode about how far Claude Code has come. And I think one of our panelists made a joke. He was like, well, the thing with Claude Code is like, it doesn't actually have like a whole lot of tools. It's like, in some ways, it's like a triumph of like, with grep, you can do anything. This almost is like, it almost feels like a little different where like one of the reasons, you know, ClaudeBot / MoltBot has really taken off has been that the open source community has built so many integrations and that like these tool integrations are really like what's giving it a lot of juice. And so I'm kind of left with kind of a question about like, well, are agents really dependent on lots and lots of tools? Or maybe we don't need a whole lot of tools. Do tools even determine whether or not an agent is successful? Curious if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's a great segue here. Very good question. And I think, you know, what MaltBot here or ClawBot is doing, it's kind of challenging this vertical integration concept or the vertical integration hypothesis, because there is a growing debate that for agents to be truly functional, they need to be vertically integrated, meaning the model, the OS, the hardware need to work like one, as, you know, we find, for example, in Apple's approach. But what MaltBot is doing here is challenging this by providing this loose open source layer that can be incredibly powerful if it has full system access. And so I think we're seeing here a spectrum. It's not like a binary thing, but it's kind of a spectrum. Like if you look at horizontal agents like MaltBot, they show general autonomy and execution. If you look at vertical agents, like what we see in the industry, they show specialized, context-rich automation. And I think maybe the real winners may be hybrid. You can have these open platforms that are modular enough to integrate deeply when needed, but could also be flexible enough to run locally or across domains. So I truly believe that it's going to be kind of something in between. It doesn't have to be, you know, fully horizontal or vertical. It can be something in between. And it's not just about, you know, accessing all the tools. It depends also on the tasks, you know, what you want to do. So real world usefulness, I think, of course, requires integration with contacts, with workflows, whether that is vertical specialization or modular plugins for broader platforms. I think what MaltBot here is proving is that autonomy and integrations, they really aren't limited to large enterprises. They can also be community driven, which is very interesting here.
Totally. Yeah. And I think that would be like, it seems to me that's like a strong argument for open source in the space, is that there's an ability for the community to build a lot of integrations for what they want to integrate with. And so it's kind of like, you could make an argument that, you know, this kind of like, oh, it's really good for the getting things done community kind of works in the open source environment, because it's like a small, intense enough community that they can really run ahead with the integrations. Marina, maybe like a final question on this. You know, so one of the reasons why the Mac Minis were so popular was, like Kautar is saying, like you get the coolest results if you just let it have access to the whole machine and it can just go run around and do whatever it wants on the machine. But people are like paranoid about doing that on their personal machine. So they're literally buying like a little, you know, a little second machine just for the agent to run around in. You know, Is that the future? Like, basically, like, we will have enough trust in these systems, but for a period of time to get that trust, like, we're going to literally just have to run it on another piece of hardware.
Sandboxing's a good thing. So I was going to very slightly push back against what Kautar was saying, which is the vertical integration, you need it for security. Because as if you just say, oh, this agent can go chat to whoever and use this tool and use that tool, every single one of those is a failure point over and over and over again of where you can have a security issue and risk, and one that you might not be able to track because the agent might not be aware of what they're doing. If you're doing your personal calendar management in GTD, and I'm fully supportive, God knows I'm playing around with this at home as well, great. There's only so much damage that you can probably do. If you're doing anything that is more industry, more robust, more something where it really matters, privacy and access and all those other things, you're going to need to have something that's a little bit more, I don't want to say official, but like certainly set. And so this whole thing of actually having things run in a separate place, yeah, you should be doing that. And industry is not going to say, oh, great, any open source thing, go ahead and talk to it. It's not the right thing to do. It's not safe. There's too many ways to get at things. You're going to have agents attacking other agents and being like, awesome, a vulnerability, no problem. So, and I don't think this is necessarily disproving anything in particular. I think it is fun to have the community be able to experiment. And then if you find things that seem to, you know, be valuable, great. Then you can scale it. Then you can do it properly. So it is nice to have the community experiment.
Totally. I think it's a point well taken, because I think, yeah, it's not like anyone's proposing, like, let's just take ClaudeBot and stick it on managing a hospital's medical records or like financial information or something like that.
I think the real question here is, it's not about do agents need vertical integration. It's more like what kind of integration matters most and in what context, in what domains. So, of course, vertical integration is so important, especially because of the security aspect that Marina brought. But in certain domains, maybe we don't need that, or it's not as important. So that's why I think having a hybrid approach, but also like Marina said, experimentation is so powerful, because it's going to allow us to learn what breaks, what doesn't break, and when do we need what?
Yeah, and I think one argument is that still the transition to Moltbot, ClaudeBot is like still like in some ways already a step in the direction of more trust in these systems, even with all the security stuff, right? Like we've moved from only touch this file directory to we'll let you touch everything in this computer, but only in a computer that I sandbox. And for getting things done, it's like, I'm also happy with you touching stuff like, you know, email, calendar, which is like kind of personally very sensitive. And so I guess the question is like how whether or not that ends up being a good trust bridge to, and I would be okay with it operating on the enterprise level, or whether or not that's going to be almost like its own separate track of like building up the trust in some of these systems and verifying these systems are actually what they say they are. I'm going to move us on to our next topic. Dario Amodei, CEO of Anthropic, is out with another very, very, very long essay about the social impacts of artificial intelligence. It's sort of the sequel of sorts to an essay that came out, I believe, just last year called Machines of Loving Grace, where he sort of laid out his vision for where the technology is going. And the name of this essay is The Adolescence of Technology. And, you know, what he's kind of talking about is sort of remarking that AI may be now entering a new period of maturity, going from a really early phase to, you know, its angry, rebellious adolescence, maybe. And I guess, Aaron, maybe I'll turn over to you first. I'm kind of curious what you thought of the essay. There's a lot in it to talk about it. I think one thing that definitely struck me is that Dario is not stepping down from any of his big claims about the technology. So, you know, there's one quote that he said that, you know, if we have a country of geniuses in a data center, which is his idea that we're going to have a bunch of powerful AIs in a data center someday, he says, any country who had that would, quote, have a fairly good shot at taking over the world, either militarily or in terms of influence and control, and imposing its will on everyone else. That's a really big claim. I guess, Aaron, what do you make of this essay?
Well, you know, first I'll say that human teenagers are scary enough, you know, and now whenever we get to age
so
of
we should,
teenagers.
Or AI teenagers I'm a little, are also similarly scary.
That's right. So put the two together, you know, it's a force multiplier for risk, right? So as I looked at the essay, something I noticed was that, you know, he largely avoided, you know, the idea of sentience or the ability of systems to feel or to have the subjective experience. You know, so it seems like he was saying that AI risk is mostly from sapience, right, rather than sentience, right? Where sapience is the capability to think intelligently. So that, in essence, that most AI risk comes from sapience without sentience. You know, so it's about this high intelligence, you can optimize, autonomy, without any feelings or morals, right? You know, we could sort of think about it like this, where sentience determines, you know, things like morals, and sapience determines capability, right, and thinking. You know, but my question and thought is, what happens when sentience coexists with sapience, right? That's where it gets even more scary, where things like alignment now becomes like things like negotiation, right, with these agents. But that's where I was starting to think about, you know, more about adding those two elements together. But going back to the essay, just thinking in terms about this really powerful AI that he had described, you know, is that it seems like what we're doing is this early adult safety for a technology that's soon to have this adult or greater than adult level of capability, right? So it's going to be systems that could be smarter than, you know, PhD levels. And in some cases, they already are, right? I mean, it's pretty incredible what you can do. But I did like, you know, some of the concerns that he raised, right? So there's, you know, this uneven adoption, right, of this tech, right, where leading labs will invest heavily in this technology, but all of these smaller labs, they may not, right? So it's like the bigger you are, maybe the better advantage you have. And there's also pace mismatch that I really thought he outlined very well, right, is that, you know, this... the innovation of AI is exponentially growing, but at the same time, it seems like these safety measures are linearly, you know, progressing, right? If that, right? So I think that, you know, it could be safeguards, it could be policy, right? But that mismatch, right, in pace of those two areas seem to be a nice call out, you know, by him. And lastly, you know, I think this global coordination gap, you know, just seeing, you know, what's happened geopolitically across the globe, right, is a risk in and of itself, right, and that some of that also needs to be sort of taken into account. But yeah, I mean, it's a good call out, you know, brings out, you know, major societal, ethical, and geopolitical concerns, right, that I think are certainly warranted.
Yeah, for sure. Well, so there's, I think, two things in what you said. I think one of them is how he thinks about where the technology is going just from its, you know, advancement. And then I think there's another bit, which is like, where does the risk come from? And we should probably talk about both of them. I mean, to the first point, Kautar, do you buy his projection, right? Like that this technology is going to be smarter than every PhD, you know, in pretty short order. You know, kind of curious about how you size that up, because it still sounds, I mean, people have been making these claims for a long time, but it still sounds a little sci-fi, at least to my ears.
Well, but I think the decades, you know, especially the past few years, we have a lot of proof points. I mean, even in his essay, he always, you know, says, you know, there is a little bit of uncertainty that, you know, maybe in 2 years that we're going to have these country of geniuses that are super intelligent, much smarter than us, having all these virtual interfaces and so on, do things 100x faster than us. So there's, of course, a little uncertainty. But I think the pace that we've seen so far in how AI has progressed, and even now, you know, like Claude, for example, in Anthropic, most of the code is written by the LLMs. And you know, so we're seeing really evidence that AI is really outperforming us in many situations. And so I think if the pace continues like this, soon we'll have this super. So I buy, you know, I think his argument just based on, you know, the evidence that we have seen so far. But, you know, I think if you look at the essay, I also agree with what Aaron said. So there is kind of it reflects a maturity shift here among the AI lab leaderships. So it's like when you look at the early phases of the AI boom, there was a lot of emphasis on excitement, the scaling curve, the opportunity. But now we're seeing a more sober kind of outcry here.
Like,
or,
what do we build?
Right? We're seeing this turn toward, you know, kind of now we have to have this existential responsibility, you know. It's like shift also that exposes some contradiction. The same actors that are warning about the danger are also often the ones building these most powerful systems. And, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's a productive interpretation. You know, we can view it as a call for co-evolution. Like Aaron said, you know, technology must advance, but at the same time, safety institutions must advance at a comparable speed. But that's not what we're seeing right now, which is kind of having this essay make these warnings. You know, we're not really advancing. I think Aaron said it very nicely. We have this exponential advancement in AI capabilities, but the safety and then the control and the rules and the regulations, they're growing linearly. And if we continue at this pace, that's really going to be very dangerous. This lab leader, Dario, is realizing that we're no longer just building products, but we're shaping a new phase of civilization. So we have to be very careful here.
I guess, Marina, to bring you into this conversation, you know, I think one of the greatest ironies of all of the big lab companies is, on one hand, you do have kind of like a rhetoric and a vision, which is like, we're working on this kind of transformational technology. But it's like, most of the revenue from Anthropic is like APIs for enterprises, like needing to create an assistant that does like customer service or something like that. And so this is like really interesting split screen between like, we're building a thing that would allow a country to take over the world, and most of the revenue coming from like, I just need to make sure my JSON is well formatted. Can we make sure that that happens? And so that split screen still, I guess, like, I see the argument on Kowtow's side. Curious about how you size that up.
I really like the point that you're making, which is the difference between vision, which pushes us to try things, and reality, which tends to be, look, we're solving practical problems. I like that Dario writes this essay and that other people write these kind of essays. I wonder to what extent people outside of Silicon Valley are able to engage with this kind of content appropriately. Because what he's trying to do here to a large extent is why people write, why people communicate. We are trying to work through philosophically, psychologically, what is going on here. And it is less important precisely what he says. It's more important that as a reader with different backgrounds, you go through, maybe with a beer or beverage of your choice, and you go, yes, or no, or that's dumb, or but you don't know about this. Like, that is a really important thing to be doing. It's a little difficult to engage with a 40-page essay in that sense. And one thing that I really do want to bring up here is, remember, as this technology continues to go forward, it is going to be defined in uncountable ways by a very small set of people. Just a few labs, just a few folks with really specific backgrounds, things that they don't think about, ways for other people throughout the entire world to engage, not via necessarily essays like this, is going to continue to be extremely important. Because you're right, on the one hand, it's tech that solves problem. On the other hand, the way we think about this technology is as important, if not more important, than what the actual technology is doing, the effect it actually has on what we think we've done. Because there's going to be that gap between perception and reality. That's how humans function. And I think that that's something that's extremely important right now, is having that engagement be more brought in with people. We were talking about ClaudeBot. How many people can actually do this? In Silicon Valley, it feels like everyone, but guys, we're this big. Then there's like everyone else that isn't doing this. So you really got to keep this in mind a little bit when talking about the specifics that are said. And I'm more interested in sort of like the medium of the message and what that has to do with how other people, not just us, are taking on this technology and where they think it's going to go.
There are some really deep themes here. There is the concentration of power, which is saying like a small number of organizations control extremely capable system. There's also this acceleration gap, which is the competitive dynamics that push labs to move faster, even when caution, you know, here is warranted. And there's also the governance gap here, like these laws, norms, and institutions, they move much slower than, you know, technical capability, and which creates, you know, this big gap that we need to figure out how to solve. So really deep,
I agree, but I would like to see engagement here from economists, from historians, from anthropologists, from other people who are aware and have studied these themes much, much, much longer than the software engineers have. And to have that kind of a back and forth so that, again, it does not just turn into an echo chamber.
Yeah, no, I think that's super important. And yeah, I think that's like, I don't know, like, I don't know if I agree with all the claims in the piece, but I do also appreciate the kind of thinking in public, right? That this is sort of an essay that is not like, it's clearly not like the result of a long like comms and PR process. No sensible PR agency would ever release something like this. And so, you know, the idea to kind of get access to at least how this person who is well positioned within the industry thinks does seem like really valuable for
and
the
Tim,
debate,
right? I really like the analogy he used, the adolescence, because it's like an adolescent. You know, we don't want to stop the growth of the adolescent, but we really need to guide the adolescent. And I think that's what's the real message here.
Yeah, we're going through our like pimply, got to get ready for high school prom kind of era for AI.
It's just pulling on that thread more, you know, with teenagers. You know, you have to have psychologists, you have to have counselors, you know, we need the same sort of, you know, safety net, right, around these types of systems as they come, you know, to usher them into adulthood, right? So, I mean, it would be a great to see something like the UN, right? You know, come together, right, and focus a bit on AI. There is the EU AI Act. There's the U.S. executive orders. The China's, you know, AI rules. But there needs to be some global, you know, organization, right, that can sort of take the reins and start thinking more about this quickly, so it can catch up and on that exponential, you know, growth curve of AI, so that, you know, the safety net policy arrangement could stay on that same growth curve.
Yeah, who's going to play guidance counselor? It's an important question.
That's exactly right.
Aaron, I feel like I'm going to break your character on MOE. Every time you're on the show, Aaron, it's always a sports and AI integration that you're usually talking about. But you're actually on the show today, in addition to kind of offering your opinions on the topics of the day, to talk a little bit about what you all are doing, not with AI and sports this time, but instead AI and the Grammys. And I know this is connected to your work on fan communities and fan engagement in general, but do you want to talk about what you've been working on?
The Grammys is one of my favorite events. You know, that was one of the places where I thought I would never be, you know, first of all. And secondly, I never thought I'd be in a tuxedo writing code, right? but I was, you know, and I was just looking at myself. I was like, what is happening here? You know,
yeah, who's
a tuxedo
this? Yeah, it's hard
writing
to picture
code.
You in a tux. So.
You don't want to, right? So we built what was called Grammy IQ, and it was a really interesting, it's a gamified experience for fans, you know, all around the world, right? Where which is actually live right now, you know. So if you go to Grammy.com, you look at the bottom right corner of the page, you can see this bot, right? And if you click it, opens up, and then you can log in and play a trivia game, right? And what it does is it allows like these users to play a game of both knowledge and speed, you know. So the more you know about music, and the faster you are, the more points that you can accrue, right? And the way it works, just really quickly, is that a fan can play two rounds, right? And you have five questions over those two rounds. The faster that you can answer a question, it's a multiple choice question, the more points you get, because there is a decay function that I put in there with a half-life of 5 seconds, you know, so it decays very, very quickly. Once you get towards the tail end, you know, after that 5 second half-life. But you can also get bonuses, right? So you can get a streak bonus to encourage people to keep coming back to play, right? So you can have AI in your hands, right? So the more consecutive days you play, the more bonus points you get. Also, social sharing. If you share where you are on a board where we show all the leaders, then you get extra bonus points. And finally, around completion. You know, so the longer you stay in the experience, the more points you get. And to sort of round all of this out, just by playing, you can be entered into winning two tickets to the 2027 Grammy Awards, right? So there is a real sweepstakes involved here. But one of the more interesting aspects is that if you were to look underneath the hood at how this works, it's this agent marketplace that we've built, right? It's these super agents that use, you know, the classic A2A and MCP, right? And these agents are in graphs, and they collaborate as writers, you could say editors, judges, and even retracting these types of info. You know, so we create these trivia packages, you know, that are human ready, such that people can see it. And it includes questions, clues, tell me more information, possible answers, And then, of course, it marks the right answer. It's pretty cool.
And so the questions are being like generated kind of on the fly, or is it kind of like they're just kind of doing the curation bit?
So it's sort of like, I would say 80%, you know, we create these question packages in a batch job, and then the other 20% is on the fly, right? So it is like a really conversational aspect. You can ask questions about Taylor Swift, for example, right? You know, and then it actually goes out and it pulls information, right? And these agents communicate, work together to call what's important and bring it back to you, right? So that's pretty neat, right? And we do have human in the loop AI, right? So we do have not many, right? But a few humans that can go in and review the packages if need be. You know, so for example, after the Grammys happens, right, like stats will change, you know, because somebody's going to win an award. And so their stat count goes up. We need to make sure that that's accounted for and it's updated, right? Right. So we do have that human in the loop there. I mean, it's, you know, it is a lot of content that comes through, but it is available, you know. And again, I would encourage you to go check it out, right? Just go to Grammy.com again. You can even go to IQ.Grammy.com as well and see the board with all the leaders on it. You can sign in and all of that. And the last thing I'll say is that building this, you know, it was equal parts fun, but it's also brutal, right? I mean,
tell us about the brutal bit.
So the hard part was security, right? Because anytime that people log in, right, you have to manage all of their data, right? And we had to do a lot of this with passing back and forth with the Recording Academy and then IBM systems. And we use things like JWTs, right, to anonymize different tokens and IDs. We had to protect PII info, but just the integration to make sure that small things like logging, right, that we weren't logging personal information out and that the PII was stored in the data places of where it's supposed to go was fairly complex. But the fun part, you know, was getting sort of being an artist, right, and orchestrating how these agents work together to create all these AI packages and then watching, you know, people play. You know, I'm sitting here on my database, watching people play, watching the results come in, and it's very fun, you know, seeing that happen.
That's really cool. So I think I would encourage people to check it out. I think maybe one last question for you, Aaron, on this is, I'm really interested in how these fan experiences sort of evolve in the era of Claude Code. What I mean by that is, in the past, it would have been very expensive for a group of, say, fans of the Grammys to like roll their own quiz experience. And they probably couldn't do anything as complex as what you're putting together on the official website. But, you know, getting a Claude Code agent to build you like a little quiz is something that could totally happen nowadays. And so I'm really interested in like how you feel about like whether or not you think in the future fan experiences are going to become more unified with time, in that like everybody will go to IQ.Grammy.com and kind of play the official experience, or if we're going to actually have more segmentation over time, like you actually find that like lots of fans will be kind of like launching their own interactive experiences around, say, a sports game or an award show. And like you actually see kind of like people's attention kind of break into a lot of smaller communities. Curious if you have any bets on that.
Yeah. So two things on that. You know, one is data ownership, I think, is what matters the most, right? So the Recording Academy, you know, controls, you know, lots of the data here, right? Sure, some of it is open source. And then once you go to other domains, like in, let's say, the medical domain, right? Certain hospitals and so on will own their own data stores, right? So data will still be somewhat siloed just for privacy and protection, as well as, you know, likeness, you know, type contracts that are in play, right? So I think just with that, right, that some of these experiences will have to have either contracts, you know, with the data providers and so on, right? So there's that aspect. The other would be scale, right, and cost, right? Building, you know, productized large-scale systems is very difficult, right? And it's not a trivial undertaking. Whenever you look at inference, right, many, even if you go to like AWS, you know, you're limited to like 12 RPS, 12 requests per second, whenever you want to run an inference model. And if you think about it, we have thousands and millions of users using these systems. So we have to invent different strategies and caching ways, semantic caching, right, to sort of tackle that, right? So those aspects, a real commercial type system, I think is very far away, right, from being splintered off, right, and to these other, you know, like personalized, you know, where like one person could go create it. But on the other hand, you know, for software development, we do use tools like IBM's Bob, right, to help us, you know, go quicker and write code faster, right, and it does help us to organize better as a team, and it helps us to really focus on the human more rather than the semantics and syntax of code, right, which is a great thing to do for I think experiences for our fans.
Well, that's awesome. I encourage people to check it out. So you said iq.grammy.com.
Yeah, or just plain, you know, if it's easier, go to grammy.com and then you also see it at the bottom right of that page. It's like this little blue little pin at the right side. Just click it, then it pops up and have fun.
Cool.
And a good luck winning those 2027 Grammy tickets.
Those tickets, yeah. I would love it if it turns out an MOE listener does this. So if you're out there listening, we're all on the same team. Get those tickets.
If you win it, I will go with you.
Oh, great. Okay, yeah, in your tux. So.
That's right.
Last topic of the day, interesting story popped up. I wanted to make sure that we do make a nod to all the goings about in semiconductors and chips land. Microsoft has announced the latest generation of its inference chip, the Maya 200, and it is sort of implementing, and part of the announcement is that they're already kind of deploying it for effectively Microsoft's internal superintelligence team, and they want to roll it out to more customers with time. I wanted to mention this story not because it's fairly unique at this point for a company to have its own inference chip. I think, in fact, almost all major big tech companies now have their own chip, which is, I think, what I really wanted to talk about and I think is a really interesting part of the game. Kautar, where do you think this ecosystem goes? Like, do you think over time, you know, essentially every single big tech company with a cloud particularly will have their own inference chip? And that will be the future, right? Like that, maybe NVIDIA will continue servicing all of them, but pretty much everybody will have their own first party silicon that they're using.
I think that's for this to have this kind of hardware sovereignty and also inference is becoming the dominant cost center. It is a big cost. So, and what Microsoft is doing, similar to what others like following the footsteps of Google's TPU, Amazon, Trainium, Inferentia, they're trying to reduce their NVIDIA tax. And they're claiming that this is doing this on their own silicon is about 30% cheaper than doing it on NVIDIA. And that's a huge, you know, cost saving. So I think it's all about this vertical integration across their stack, which provide them better co-optimizations with the software stack because they know the hardware. They know how to place these models. They know how to schedule these things on the hardware. So they have a lot more control over, you know, the entire stack going all the way from the applications to the compilation phases down to the silicon. So that gives a lot of control here. And also they're designing these chips specifically for their infrastructure. For example, the Maya 200 is designed specifically for the Azure's infrastructure. And it is, they're claiming it's optimized to run models like GPT-4o more efficiently and cheaply than the general purpose GPUs. So I think it's a kind of a foundry strategy here. And I think the most interesting angle here is like Microsoft here is becoming its own customer, similar to what the others are doing, like Google and Amazon. And so by deploying these things, you know, for their LLMs, for their co-pilots, they're essentially bypassing, you know, this NVIDIA, you know, big cost for their highest volume services. So this isn't just a chip. It's kind of a margin protector here. Every token generated, as I mentioned, is 30% more profitable for Microsoft than a token generated on an NVIDIA chip they had to buy. And I think, so we're witnessing here kind of this de-NVIDIA thing. So, and I think it's, you know, the narrative here, it's, you know, really having this margin protector. So, and it, we're witnessing kind of this reversal of decades of horizontalizations in computing. Instead of having this generic hardware plus profitable software, I think major players are returning to this vertically integrated stacks.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know, Marina, this is one of the things I'm really interested in is like, say what you will about NVIDIA, but one benefit of everybody using NVIDIA for a period of time was that you could kind of like develop for them and develop on top of their platforms. And it would just work across almost everywhere. It kind of feels like maybe one thing that could happen with this verticalization is that, you know, obviously these companies are paying for inference chips for their own work. But also the idea is to kind of like create lock-in, right? Like it sort of seems like in the future, you'll have all these platforms that are actually pretty different to design for and are optimized for different things. Will it make it more difficult to go cross-platform over time?
Of course it is, because just as NVIDIA has been playing with making its own models and putting those out as well, I think everybody needs to try to understand where is the long-term economic sustainability. Right now, we've definitely switched to spending more time on inference than on training, as Kautar said. And especially the more we get into this agent world where you have to do a lot of calls over and over and over again, rather than necessarily train a whole lot of things. This makes more and more of a difference. Again, where are you going to make money with this long term? How are you going to make it difficult for people to just keep switching from one place to another? Yeah, this is a very natural place to be, and you need some years to run up there. This is the same reason that you got these companies really investing in that infrastructure, in the data centers, in the chips, et cetera. I mean, even if the AI models change, this investment infrastructure is kind of nice. It's like how we got the internet tubes, even though the first round of internet crashed a little economically, but that was good. So
yeah,
this
we
is
like laid down the groundwork. So
yeah, yeah, and then we keep using it. So I mean, chips can also be used for other things, and infrastructure can be used for other things. So that's also nice if we end up changing where we're going in terms of the architecture, the software, the things that go on top. At least we will have gained a good amount of experience in how to do that. But yes, economically, this is just following the same playbook as has been done many times before, and for really good reason. Capitalism continues.
Yeah, right. Aaron, I'll ask the obvious question we always ask when we do these stories is, should I be selling my NVIDIA stock? Should I be buying more NVIDIA stock? Not that you're giving out any financial advice, of course, to be clear. But, you know, I guess to phrase it in an easier way, like, how worried should NVIDIA be about all of this push towards verticalization?
Well, not to quote Jim Cramer, but I think diversifying your portfolio is always a good thing.
One word, you should buy index funds.
exactly right. EFTs at those too, right? Be great.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
So this to me is more of like an incremental step into hardware. But it's a strategic one, right? At that, you know, because it helps to optimize existing AI silicon design principles. It's very efficient at scale. I did want to sort of like yes and, you know, off of everybody here on the panelists is that just how incredibly expensive it's become, you know, for inference. You know, it's like 15 times more expensive, right? So if you run the numbers and think about how much it costs to train like a GPT-4, it was over $100 million. I think around like $150 million. But then if you look at, you know, how much would it cost to run inference over 5 years, you're looking at the billions, right? Just because of the number of calls that you have. And if they, Microsoft can truly cut the cost of 30%, you know, that's huge. It is very huge. I mean, you're looking at $3.5 billion, you know, of inference cost over 5 years, right? Assuming the economies of scale, you know, maintain what they are, you know, today. So there's a lot of caveats to those numbers, but either way you slice and dice, that's a huge savings, right? That in turn could be used to churn out the next, you know, sort of S curve in this hardware innovation, which I hope would be neuromorphic computing. Right, because here at IBM, you know, we have these North Pole chips, right? That are sort of along those lines, but it uses like these spiky neural networks. It's really, really power efficient, You know, so you can have these low power sensors that run on the edge for these ultra low power pieces, and you know that in turn would give us to the next sort of evolution, which would be less of an incremental but more of a revolutionary step, which is I think we're seeing an incremental step here.
From my perspective, NVIDIA should be worried about its margins, but not its leadership, because you know the era of having kind of 75% gross margins on every chip may be ending as just maybe good enough custom silicon from Microsoft or Amazon takes over, you know, their routine task, because they were among, you know, the top consumers, you know, for NVIDIA chips. And that equation is changing. But, you know, for the most advanced, you know, frontier models like GPT-5 or Claude 4, NVIDIA's like Rubin or the Blackwell Ultra, they still remain the only hardware capable of handling the complexity at scale. So they still have a big edge here. So, but, you know, of course, you know, a lot of these things are changing, especially because the importance is the cost here, the performance. The cost per performance is becoming super important for inference. And that's why you're seeing all these specializations happening.
Yeah. I did want to note too that this particular chip, you know, it's for low precision AI, right? So it's for, again, it's for most of what the general public does, but it's not what everybody does, right? So if you need a high precision AI piece, then you would obviously go to a different chip, you know, that could handle floating points a bit differently, right? So, you know, I think I said this before in the podcast, but the whole no free lunch theorem, right? It all depends on the problem that you're trying to solve to select what you're going to use, right? Is quite important. And I look forward to whenever, you know, there's like a hyperscaler that can pick the type of chip to run your problem on. So you're abstracted away from this, right? And it becomes a really hybrid AI architecture, you know, in the cloud.
Well, here at MOE, you get investment advice, you get the Grammys, you get the potential end of the world due to AI. So you get everything. I love this panel. So Aaron, Marina, Katsar, thanks for joining us. And that's all the time that we have for today. And appreciate all you listeners joining us. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you next week on Mixture of Experts.